And I'm grateful to be here with all of you. I want to thank Sangha Live. I always enjoy teaching through this forum. And as I look to read the places where all of you are from, I feel lit up. I'm here today in the mountains and forest of Western North Carolina, which is originally Cherokee land. And before we dive in today, I'd like to simply invite you into a brief centering, just to invite you to settle in before our meditation and our exploration of today's topic. So if you will, rest your eyes either closed or open in a soft gaze. And please begin by taking in three of the deepest and slowest breaths you have taken today. Just feeling the air as it enters your body, fills your body, and leaves your body. Beginning to welcome yourself into this space, into this shared field. And as your breath returns to its natural rhythm, just notice what that is in this moment. Gently bringing awareness to the pace and quality of your mind. And welcoming your mind as it is. You might be present to calm, clear mind. You might be arriving with busy, racing, monkey mind. So just no need to resist. It's the mind's nature to think. Just let yourself be aware. And then bring a little more awareness to how you're feeling. For some of you, it's morning. Some of you, afternoon or evening. Just notice how at this point in the day you're feeling. Notice any emotions that might be here. And whether you're present to a sense of ease, feeling well-resourced, feeling vitality, a light heart, or whether you are present to arriving with tenderness, a deep sadness, an agitation. Please again welcome yourself as you are. Really allowing our Sangha space, allowing our practice to welcome all, to welcome the whole of who we are. No one and nothing left out. And so gently now, just bring a little more awareness to your physical body. Noticing the sensations that are moving through you right now. And just consciously allowing your body to be here as it is. Again, you might be arriving in physical well-being, ease, and you might be working with a particular physical challenge today. So I invite you to take very kind care of yourself, always honoring our body every step of the way in practice. And in this moment, I'd like for you to get in touch with your intention for being here today. for showing up for the Sangha Live community. Just allow a word or phrase to arise. What motivated you to be here? Please gently now open your eyes. Welcome once again, perhaps a sense of feeling a little more settled. And anyone who'd be willing to share your intention, your motivation in the chat box, I would certainly appreciate that before we dive in. Just inviting you to bring your voice in. And later in our session, one of the sweetest parts is when your voice is invited in for questions and reflections, okay? And what I'd like to ask is, I'll just take a minute to read a few of these. Curiosity, community, gratitude, solidarity, deepening practice, love, deeper learning, hope, connectedness, beautiful. Okay. So today's teaching comes from my heart to yours in the context of engaged Dharma, in the context of a real appreciation for relational ways of knowing, relational intelligence, attunement, and what our Dharma practice has to teach us about this domain, which intuition and conscious use of our imaginations stem from. There's also a seed of eco-dharma in today's talk. And you'll hear me draw upon teachings from the natural world often. And yet it's interesting, that phrase eco-dharma always invokes curiosity in me because I don't actually know of any Buddha Dharma that isn't eco-dharma, that does not recognize the natural world as our greatest teacher, and that doesn't teach us how to remember a care for the world we inhabit that comes from embodied interconnection with this earth, with all that is. So that said, let's prepare for meditation. Allow yourself to find a posture of dignity, a position that is upright and both relaxed yet attentive at the same time. You can either rest eyes closed or open in soft gaze, your eyes relaxed in their sockets. You might begin by taking in another deep, full body breath. Simply inviting relaxation. And I invite you to become aware of your body's relationship with gravity, feeling your sits bones grounded on the surface beneath you, feeling and sensing the earth beneath you, the ground supporting you, the earth coming up to hold you, and allowing your attention to fold now from the external to the internal. Begin to bring awareness to the internal landscape. Anchoring in your breath and simply beginning to notice the climate of the body in this moment. To notice what's in your heart. As you feel the air entering your body, filling your body and leaving your body. Let's allow this very breath to remind us of our interconnection with all that is. This oxygen coming from the forests, the oceans, the phytoplankton, the stardust of our world. This breath being the same breath that our dharmic and karmic ancestors breathed. And begin now to become more aware of the outer landscape, the space surrounding you. Being curious about where your physical body ends and the space around you begins. And I invite you to stay connected with breath and body while you let yourself just receive the sounds surrounding you. The air touching your skin. Perhaps a sense of that which exists beyond the windows and walls of the space sheltering you. And let yourself rest now in awareness of the inner and outer at the same time. Just being here, aware of awareness itself animating you. Perhaps aware of the spaciousness of awareness, which can hold all of you. Perhaps aware of a sense of mind and body integrating. Nothing to do as we meditate together. Nothing to fix or change or solve. nothing to strive for. Nowhere to get to. Allowing yourself to be here exactly as you are. Allowing life to be as it is. And as we continue to meditate together, allowing awareness to expand organically, with each breath, notice what's here for you in the mirror of stillness today. And if you observe thoughts beginning to pull you away from presence, just gently notice what's pulling and kindly but firmly bring yourself back here. Being with what is. Inviting yourself into intimacy with what is here and now. If you notice efforting, or certainly if you notice mental strain while we're meditating, just give yourself full permission to soften effort, to effort less, to rest here, to let yourself as you are be held by awareness. Nothing to do and nowhere to get to. Remember that we don't meditate to reach an end goal or attain the enlightened state. We meditate to remember and recognize the already awakened state. Awareness is already awake. So just let yourself rest here. I invite you now to gently begin to allow your breath to deepen. As you do so, notice if there are any places in your body that you want to invite to soften just a little more. If you'd like to, you can rest a hand at the center of your heart. And as we begin to bring our meditation to a close, let's take a minute to turn towards gratitude. Just acknowledging within yourself that which you feel bone deep gratitude for in this moment. That which you do not take for granted. Just noticing the impact on your body of gratitude. Be sure to include yourself in your gratitude right now, appreciating this being, appreciating your practice. Perhaps appreciating how you have navigated challenge or growth recently. And let's take in together one more deep breath, breathing in deeply, exhaling fully. So as we move into our Dharma talk and then our discussion, I invite us to stay in the mind of meditation, just really resting together in deep listening. We can think of meditation as a practice of listening to life as it unfolds moment by moment. And of course, we listen by relaxing the body, connecting with the quality of openness, curiosity, our natural receptivity. And as I share these reflections today, please notice how and where they touch you. Notice what gets lit up when you turn to your own experience. So consider that we are imaginal beings and we are relational beings. We exist in relationship in every moment of our time here. A beautiful aspect of Dharma practice is that we are choosing to be fully here, rather than imagining a better, a different, a grass is greener over there reality. We are not pitting an imagined reality against this moment as it is, but choosing to surrender to this moment, to life as it is, to fully open our hearts to life as it is right now. That's both beautiful and freeing. At the same time, we are actively and subconsciously using our imaginations all the time. Each night in the dark, you dream. Every day we are using our imaginations, thinking, thinking, thinking. Oftentimes using this imagination to affirm the myth, the trance of separation, the illusion that we are separate, and then acting in ways that affirm our participation in this trance, the myth of separation. So we're literally imagining that we are separate. We're using our imaginations all the time to feed stories that have been passed down generation upon generation, stories that come from the legacy of patriarchy and colonialism, capitalism, individualism. Again, stories that are not inherently true. We're often, when faced with the great unknown, known as humans, to turn towards our imagination to feed stories of fear, to fill in that vast empty space of unknown with fear or anticipation or biggest nightmare. And so one of the reasons I wanted to talk about both intuition and imagination today is that we're at such a pivotal moment in time as human beings. In this age of global uncertainty, there is so much invitation and opportunity to both practice the grace of resting in not knowing, the grace of surrendering to this moment as it is and opening our hearts fully. And as we open our hearts fully, we also open our capacity for relational forms of knowing, our innate capacity as human beings, because this is part of who we actually are. It's part of true nature to be attuned with all of life, to rest in deep listening. So consider that as relational beings, in relationship every moment that we are alive, when we get caught in the mind of separation and limitation, we're making our primary relationship, the small self, the separate self, me and my little bubble. And a gift of practice is that it allows us to wake up again and again and again, because this practice is a remembering from this bubble, so that we can be in conversation with all of life, so that we can be here for the conversation life wants to have with us, so that we can be in communion and attunement with the entire cosmos, so that we can open ourselves up to have the needed and essential conversation, which happens moment by moment by moment. Gil Fronsdale, who's a Dharma teacher I deeply respect, speaks of intuition as when we allow the entire world to speak to us. Yeah? And consider for yourself, just in your own practice, the degree to which a natural, innate capacity for listening, for receptivity, being open to receiving life as it is, and the clear seeing that comes from that. Your innate capacity for sensitivity and compassion for the life that you feel and sense around you. Consider the degree to which this has deepened through your practice. And yet oftentimes it's not the aspect of practice that we talk too much about. I notice, especially in this age where we are all paying attention even more subtly to unconscious biases that we're carrying, we want to be aware of the intersubjective nature of conditioning, so that there's both personal conditioning that you may have received from your family lineage, from personal experiences or traumas you've had in this life, from religion, the media as well. There's intersubjective conditioning. So we might believe in some form of that which is absolutely not true, some form of nonsense. And yet our neighbor is also believing it. Our friend is also operating from it. So we need to really equally investigate those places. And even within the gift of the field of Dharma, meditation, Buddhism, there are unconscious biases that have been passed down that we can open our eyes to. And one that I've noticed, and you can look within and see if you've noticed this in your own practice or your own life, is that sometimes that divide that's so alive in our world between rational mind or rational understanding or cognitive understanding and other forms of knowing gets made. So we're always looking in practice at where am I holding, where am I feeding hierarchical perception? Because we're not free, we're not clear seers until we let go of this seed of hierarchical perception. And even in that duality, rationalization over here, other forms of knowing, intuition over here, which has led so many people I've mentored over the years, notice that they discount their intuition or they discount relational forms of knowing. And I very much want to name this because this is a moment in time for humanity when it is so vitally important that we are as present as we can be in this moment, aware, attuned, and allowing life to guide us. So the metaphor that I'll share is a rich one for me personally right now, because in the mountains and forests where I live in North Carolina, we spend a lot of time simply exploring the deep, dark woods off trail. And to imagine the experience of moving through a darkened forest without a brightly lit path, without a sign pointing the direction. In the dark, we are invited to soften the mind of discrimination, the brightly lit mind of habit, knowing, and to allow deeper source of knowing and our full body perception to open. And this is, of course, also a metaphor for meditation and the Dharma path. Many wisdom traditions throughout the world consider darkness an ally in opening our relational capacity, learning how to see in the dark, which is akin to learning how to see clearly. So in this time in particular for our collective, we're on this similar journey where many of our familiar relied upon systems have been seen as fragile in recent years, where we are navigating global uncertainty, where there is a collective not knowing. And there can be the seduction in times like these to go into the mind of limitation and separation, to go into imagining the worst, imagining through fear, false evidence appearing real. And we can also really see the opportunity to attune more deeply, to sense and listen more deeply to our inner guidance, which is core to practice, to meditation, to field consciousness, we consciousness. So insight that arises from we do not know where, no need to take ownership of it, no need to know where, but to know how to listen, how to attune, and how to recognize truth. Equally, to have it as part of your practice to, through inquiry, bring awareness to how to recognize delusion when you are being pulled off by a story. We can know that that which we are unconscious to silently governs us. So we're continually learning how to bring awareness in practice to our conditioned beliefs and to the known felt sense from presence, from a deeper place of what is of essence, of our connection to source. So just pause and notice how my words are impacting you today. As we are opening to intuition and to insight, there's a couple of things that are very helpful. And it'll take us back into the forest for a moment. And acknowledge that if we were going into a dense, dark forest, perhaps hoping to spot a rare bird, we wouldn't trek loudly and hurriedly, forcefully into the forest. We would really want to rest in stillness. In listening, we'd want to move mindfully so that we can feel and sense with our whole bodies, so that we can be in touch with somatic awareness, right? We want to just pause and sit and listen so that we can be here, so that we can be open when that rare bird moves through. That's like receiving insight or intuition. We can't go after it. We can be here for it, which is being here with patience and humility. My husband is a flower essence healer, so he makes medicine of wildflowers. So we spend time going out into natural landscapes, hoping to find certain flowers. And it's very similar, trekking so gently, listening enough that we can hear and pick up signs and signals that might not come to us, certainly not through rational understanding or the English language, but they can come to us in other ways. So in practice, we're waking up from egocentricity, also from anthropocentricity, human-centeredness, to our connection with all of life on earth. Waking up from what we might call wake-centricity. Again, rational mind, who we are when we're awake, listening to the deeper undercurrents of the subconscious, listening to the language that the body speaks, the language I would say that Gaia speaks. And all of this requires opening and emptying. How relaxing, yeah? Opening and emptying. Resting in our innate receptivity. You know, with that forest metaphor that I used, I would just add a couple of things that feel important to say. One is that sometimes we choose to walk through the unknown volitionally. We make life choices. I'm ready for this. And sometimes life pulls out the rug from underneath us. Sometimes, especially important to acknowledge the inequity of our world. Some peoples can have their sense of security pulled out from under them often, or much more so than others. Of course, in practice, we're acknowledging that we are always, as human beings, every day of our life, walking through the unknown, navigating the mystery. And we can do so in openness and possibility, beginner's mind, listening, and attunement. Or we can do this by trying to fill the empty space with our imagination, pointing to fear. But in this metaphor of the forest, with our collective right now, it's a little bit more like we're in the deep, dark woods and the sun is setting quickly. There's a sense of, I don't need to say urgency, but immediacy. So we need to both be listening intently, aligned with our intention to act on behalf of the greater good, and also really being open and empty. I would like to share a teaching about two kinds of knowing we can access. And just think about how this applies to you as I speak to it. I think I'll share a brief story. When I lived as a Buddhist monastic, as a monk, and there was a certain time in my training. I was there for 7.5 years. This was maybe 5 years in, that my teacher asked me to be work director, which meant that my job, the hat I was wearing, was attending to every single administrative detail for the entire operation, for the entire monastery and retreat center. And I remember when she gave me this job, having resistance, an oh no came up. The shadows held by my Virgo self are going to be revealed. And what I got to see is this first kind of knowing that I'm going to point to, which is that when we turn to the conditioned mind as authority, okay, we like to brace against life and come up with a program to follow. We like to be told what to do and follow it. So for instance, perhaps instead of listening intuitively to our bodies, letting our bodies tell us the truth about what to eat and how to exercise and take care of ourselves, we come up with a program. Or in the case of being work director, I wanted to come up with the perfect calendar system and the perfect organization system. And the words program and system are relevant because they kept arising. And I remember my teacher, given we live surrounded by woods and we did a lot of carpentry and worked with wood at the monastery where I trained, she used the metaphor of Eden. You just have to remember that you are standing on a log in these woods and it's gently, slowly rolling downhill. It's in constant motion. It's moving downhill. All you can do is balance in this moment and the next and the next and the next and the next, letting go and surrendering to the movement of this log. Nothing you can control, no need to control, just to rest and balance in this moment, just to be here fully. And I like this metaphor because I feel that when we are in the illusion of control, we tend to feed this what I'll call the fantasy of authority. We want to an authority out there to tell us information. We turn to the conditioned mind as authority rather than listening to the authority of our hearts, or we might say, which is part of the process of practice over time, reclaiming the authority of the heart. So one of the precepts I took in Zen was not to tell lies nor practice believing the fantasy of authority. this for each and every one of us has to do with taking responsibility for your relationship to the mind and accessing your willingness to reclaim the authority of the heart, which speaks in the moment, moment by moment. We have to be here for it. Yeah. I'd like to share a couple of quotes along this topic of authority. Ehe Dogen, 13th century founder of Soto Zen, do not follow the ideas of others, but learn to listen to the voice within yourself. Your body and mind will become clear, and you will realize the unity of all things. Dogen spoke of the body of unity. And this again is part of what I pointed to in the beginning of today's talk. We can either be in conversation with the bubble of separate self, playing it quite small, or open ourselves up to the conversation life wants to have with us moment by moment. And so the other kind of seeing, which is really a seeing and sensing, which is about intuitive knowing and insight, relational forms of knowing. Really has to do with, again, emptying, resting in the openness of beginner's mind, being willing to not know, being willing to be open, naked, empty. Being willing to receive guidance in the moment, so letting life instruct you in an emergent way, rather than here's the program, here's the script, here's the system to follow. Along with taking responsibility, okay, for our use of imagination to feed conditioning and fear, to feed the myth of separation, that which is not essential, not real, not who we are. We can consciously engage in the use of our imagination to co-create with life, to help ourselves remember who we actually are, to remember non-separation. We can consciously use our imagination in this time of change for humanity, to give our energies, our life force, to imagining the world of equity and regeneration that we hold in our hearts. I want to presence a few inspirations in my life. Joanna Macy, who some of you know, who's been a core teacher for a long time for me, teaches the beautiful use of conscious imagination in practice on behalf of the greater good. To imagine the world we want to create, to connect with the feeling in our body, in our being, to share it with one another. Ruth King, incredible African-American Dharma teacher, in her work about healing racism, guides practices for imagining a world beyond racism, imagining how it would feel, what it would look like, how we would be able to show up. Theologian Martin Buber coined the term moral imagination, and that feels important to presence in this call. It points to a moral responsibility, yeah, on behalf of the collective, on behalf of the greater good, to use our imaginations to, you know, it's interesting. I think of it sometimes as, is it really imagination we're talking about, or is it active remembering? When I was navigating Lyme and an experience of being in body which felt unbearable, mysterious, unknown, and despairing at times, though I had the steadfast support of my practice to guide me, yeah, and the surrender to the mind of not knowing, I was also committed to healing, to without going into magical thinking or, again, imagining a reality other than this one, a utopia that takes us out of the moment. I had a responsibility to meet this illness from the most life-affirming place I could. And that invited me into a deep conversation into the body and a deep conversation with nature, in which conscious use of the imagination was a great part of remembering wellness. And I often thought, am I really imagining, or am I just remembering and recognizing a state that part of me has forgotten? And so just in practice, as we are remembering and recognizing who we actually are as human beings, who we actually are as a collective, there's all kinds of evidence out there, yeah, pointing to the myth of separation, pointing to individualism, pointing to the constant competition, pointing to the doom and gloom. The world news, I found it fascinating that in the U.S. where I live, throughout the pandemic, 95% of the news that was shared was bad world news, even when there were positive or inspiring or courageous or heroic efforts. And so again, that's another way that we're being fed imagination or filled by it. We can either exist remembering that what we are unconscious to silently governs us and let that govern us, or we can be taking responsibility for a very conscious relationship to it. Yeah, both dropping it when those stories of conditioning arise that pull our attention, while resting in the openness and possibility in which we can have this conversation with life I'm talking about. And lastly, we can also consciously utilize our moral imagination in ways that nourish healing. So pause and just close your eyes for a moment. Notice what you're present to through my reflections. I'd like to share a short poem by the Zen poet Ikkyu Sojin, who says, "Every day, priests minutely examine the law and endlessly chant complicated sutras. Before doing that, though, they should learn how to read the love letters sent by the wind and rain, the snow and moon." Ending with some reflections about listening to the cosmos. Yeah. So let's all open the space for questions, for reflections. And I want to let you know how much I enjoy conversation and enjoy hearing what's alive for you in this. Your questions are golden. They serve the whole here. Okay. So let's see. The first person asked, what is your definition of open as well as empty? Thank you. So let's first acknowledge that it's really easy when we're talking about these matters to think about them in binary language. So openness versus closeness, for instance. And I like to remind people that humanity has lost most of its legacy of spiritual language. Most of what we have today is marketplace language and more binary language. So we want to be aware of that. And so open, for me, certainly points to this natural innate capacity for receptivity. We can be in a moment of resisting life, but feel receptive or open towards that resistance. Yeah, we can be in a moment where we notice both openness and resistance at the same time. For me, practice is very much a continual and emerging opening towards, opening towards, turning towards, being with what is. And empty, again, without going into the binary language, we can know that when we are resting in spacious presence, resting in this moment, again, in openness to life, there is an emptying that occurs. Think of analyzing, assessing, measuring, judging, all part of the domain of filling. And as human beings, we spend a tremendous amount of time filling ourselves, while meditation is a practice of emptying. Now, just to pause and let this person know, we could spend the rest of our conversation today about openness and emptiness, because this is Buddhism. So I'm going to pause there, but acknowledge that. And the next person asks, could you offer some suggestions as to how to release the grip of the inner conversation with the authority of the mind? Yes. Yeah, thank you for that. So the first thing I would say is I find it really helpful to, in practice, have a balance between what we might call conscious allowing on one side and conscious protection on another side. This is unconventional language, but go with me on this for a moment. In meditation, we're learning how to rest, yeah, in conscious allowing, being with what is, resting in our receptivity and simply allowing life to be as it is. At the same time, even in meditation, yeah, there's a conscious protection. When we notice thoughts arise that are pulling us off center, we drop it. When we notice self-hatred or the inner critic speaking to us, we might say, no, I am turning my attention back here to affirm my connection to source. There's a conscious protection that comes even in showing up day after day after day to your meditation practice. So I encourage you, the person who asked that question, to look at that balance within yourself, and also to be aware that as you continue to do your practice, and this is very much a deconstructive practice, what is not true for who you really are will be revealed in the mirror of your practice. So with patience and non-judgment and certainly self-compassion, yeah, you'll be able to see that. And then each time we see it, we begin to lose interest in it. We begin to see more clearly the suffering it causes. The way I like to talk about it is we finally and eventually get bored of it. We get bored of conditioning. We get bored of it. And that's liberating. I want to pause. I see Jerome on the screen. And I want to acknowledge you. Great to see you, Jerome. Would you like to share your reflection or question?
Yes, I would. I'm muted.
I can hear you.
You can hear me?
Yes.
Oh, shows me mute. Anyway, I have to tell you a story, if you don't mind. This took place in 1976. I was on my way to Esalen with Gabrielle Roth to help her teach her training that week. When I got a call from my ex-wife who said my son was in the hospital and they didn't know what was wrong. So I had to cancel that trip. I rushed to the hospital, found out that he had a kidney cancer that had metastasized to his lungs. It's called a Wilms tumor. And I did not get drawn in to the authority of the medical profession. I immediately got some change and started making calls around to see what kind of alternative means we could use to improve his chances of surviving. And I also knew that once I had a chance to be in his room with him alone, without doctors, without his mother, I could teach him to do what I call a mind story, which is a guided imagination, which was oriented for the 7-year-old boy. So I proceeded to have every other night in the room with my girlfriend at the time, and we would do these visualizations together with him, and we'd do it when he was asleep. And then he got out of the hospital a month later, and we hired a psychologist to take over these mind stories. And his name was Sheldon Ruderman, who has passed away. And this technique that we taught him seemed to really work, because when he was 11 years old, this is 4 years later, 1980, he was a vibrant gymnast and a member of the San Francisco Boys Chorus. And we took him for one final meeting with the surgeon, and she told us that he had made medical history by surviving 4 years and still carrying on as an 11-year-old. He'd never seen a metastatic Wilms tumor survive until then. He is now 52, and he has a nice, beautiful 2-year-old granddaughter for me. And I'm happy to say that these mind stories have kept him alive, and they kept me alive when I got cancer in 97. So I want to thank you for your wonderful talk about the value of using the imagination and in healing as well as in dharmic life. It's a wonderful tool, and I really appreciate you. And I rushed back from a walk with my wife to be on this call. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Jerome, thank you so much. And I want to thank you for bringing Gabrielle Roth into the space, who is one of my great heroes and teachers. And also to just name for everyone in this field, so many of us have had experiences of having to navigate chronic and mysterious illness, loss, or witness others in our lives, loved ones experience this. And we are again, as a collective, navigating a bit of a mysterious collective illness, we might say, and the challenges the earth is facing. And so again, meeting these experiences, both with beginner's mind, the field that is both accepting to what is, and fully open to possibility, possibility beyond the mind of limitation and separation. This is so important, while also acknowledging where there are places for conscious use of the imagination, which is just a way of having a conversation with life beyond the bubble of separate self, where that can serve. And many of you in this group right now probably have some amazing stories to share, as Jerome did. I know I do through my own healing process. So again, in Dharma practice, we want to have this balance of acknowledging the gift of being here in this moment as it is, not pitting an imagined reality against it, because that's where our hearts open fully to the suffering of our world, while also remembering that we are imaginal creatures and co-creative creatures. Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, in 2016, I gave a Dharma talk at Deer Park Monastery. It was the Earth Holder Sangha gathering to talk about climate change. And I talked about using imagination to imagine the world we wanted to see evolve from where we were in 2016 to a view of a beautiful future for all of us.
Beautiful, beautiful. Thank you, Jerome. You know, I'm going to share a short quote by Joanna Macy that speaks a bit to this, the call for this in this time. And Joanna says, "The great turning is something we build while the great unraveling happens. The old ways become dysfunctional as the new perceptions take birth and the new needs are felt. They take root right through in the rubble of the great unraveling and the great turning. They're happening at the same time, the breaking down and the springing up. What many in systems thinking call positive disintegration, the old codes and principles we thought had the answers don't make sense anymore. They have to come apart as we allow ourselves to listen for fresh guidance." And she goes on to speak about the human discomfort, yeah, that comes through such unravelings. I want to pause and move on to the next question. And this person has said, "Anger is often my companion when it comes to unjust situations. I don't hesitate to meet a person using oppressive techniques. But after, I often feel scared, blaming myself. Why did I say, why can't I be more mellow, okay, instead of angry? There's such distance between the heat of anger and the calmness in being in emptiness, or is there?" Okay, this is a great question. I always appreciate questions about anger because I find anger such a misunderstood or misinformed often emotion for humans, and such an important one, such an important and sacred messenger. And so here's a few things that I'd like to offer. First, just to consider how many of us have been conditioned to label anger bad. Anger's over here and it's bad and wrong. And how many of us have limited choice when we get identified, which means just caught in anger. When I get caught in anger, I have pretty much two choices. I can either act it out on another, which will then lead to harm and regret, or I can internalize it, anger turned within, also harm and regret. So in this practice, we're always learning to disidentify and return to center. Disidentifying has nothing to do with disassociation, nothing. This is a practice of going down and into our bodies and of honoring and welcoming the messenger of emotion. But disidentifying means stepping back enough to fully be here with the anger, or we might say with the angry one. If you've had an experience of being full of heat and the tempest of anger, okay, while a compassionate being was here with you, that's a wildly different experience than just feeling identified with anger without witness. So we can bear witness to our own anger in this way. If we look at anger a little more closely, I like to use the metaphor of a seashell. It's like hardened surface, and yet underneath there is always, always something soft, a powerlessness, fear, a sense of vulnerability, loss. And so if we stay present with the anger itself, not judging it, not wronging it, but also not acting out from it through reactivity, presence first, okay? Then there's an ability to see more clearly. And this has to do with intuition, to intuit what's actually happening here, who in me is feeling this, what does this being need to be welcome into compassion. And there's room and space for what is appropriate response here. Sometimes there's something to voice and express outwardly, but from presence, we can do so with love and skillfulness. Yes? Again, this is part of conscious allowing and conscious protection. This is part of, well, what your question really points to is this then leads us to how to embody fierce compassion, not just the story that compassion always looks a certain way or is always gentle. We're navigating all kinds of issues right now that can easily draw anger. Social justice issues, the decimation of our planet, the imbalance between the feminine and masculine, yin and yang. There are so many things that if we're honest and honor the messenger of anger as it arises, then we can become more skillful in our response. So to go back to your question again, resting in stillness, letting the stillness itself hold the angry one, yeah? And then finding out as we look within and turn to our the authority of our hearts, what is best for all in this situation. And so when there's something to express, we receive that guidance and the guidance on how to do so skillfully. When there's something to ask for, we receive that guidance. Sometimes the guidance is just to sit with and hold in stillness. So I really appreciate that question because, again, earlier I mentioned the unconscious biases that can exist even in spiritual practice and even in Buddhism. And sometimes the words not to be angry, I would say, get misused or misunderstood. And so we try to cut off that part of us, or we judge that part of us in the name of being a good spiritual person, instead of getting it that wholeness is an invitation of this practice, wholeness, and also honoring the messenger of emotions and our human suffering. So we have a little more time. So look within and see if there's another question you'd like to ask. And I see someone has asked, how can we bring knowing to this not knowing? How can we bring knowing to this not knowing? And it's a great play of words, isn't it? So in practice, there is not a need to bring knowing to the not knowing, but a need to bring recognition to the refuge of not knowing, to the possibility of resting in not knowing. Okay, so there we are, perhaps in a situation where we're noticing, okay, the stories of fear are starting to churn. Conditioned stories making meaning about what's happening right now are starting to churn. The meaning-making machine of my mind is starting to want to fill the space. We notice by subtle investigation what's happening in our bodies, how we're feeling. And we allow ourselves to be with the discomfort, to be with moment by moment. Remember, the story is out of the moment. It exists as a whole program. This is what's happening, and this is where this is taking me. There's actually a moment by moment, step by step, in the now, emergent way to experience whatever you are meeting. And if we allow ourselves to rest, perhaps body and breath are the anchors you use in practice. We have different forms of meditation represented in this circle right now. To let yourself connect with what it would feel like to surrender to not knowing right now. What is the feeling of this? Is it a feeling of feeling very naked, or I'd like to have something to cling to? Is it the feeling of afraid of who I will be or what will be if I let go of the stories that I tend to identify with? So another way to consider it is this. I personally take heart in when fear is stirred and that sort of impulse, again, to fill the space with story. This is what's going to happen, or this is what this means. I take heart in remembering that ultimately this is ego's fear. Consider that even though we might say that we want love, intimacy, oneness, we want to know this oneness that is who we really are. For egocentric karmic conditioning, that's terrifying. It's terrifying because ego doesn't, we might say, have a place in that oneness. Ego doesn't exist. It's almost like ego death. And I have to be really careful with language right now, because this is not in any way this practice, a practice of cutting off ego or even creating a duality between ego and true nature. Let's say ego's part of us. But when we're being operated by ego, when ego's in the driver's seat, and I would say this is a practice of saying, hey, I'd rather have my heart and the present moment be guiding me. I'd rather have my heart be in the driver's seat. So I want to be aware of ego and have a lighthearted and, aware, conscious relationship to it, to what's operating me. But when I remember that it's ego's fear, it's not the fear of true nature, it allows there to be just a, we might say, germination of courage, a tendril of courage. And that tendril is all that you need, just one tendril of courage in a moment where there's also fear. And that can let you relax, surrender, rest. Those of you who've been practicing for a long time, you know that what tends to happen is there's this fear of what will be here if I'm not filling the space, or this fear of emptiness. And it's almost like a sense that emptiness is the absence of something. Just like we tend to consider darkness the absence of light, which is absolutely not. Writing a book on that topic right now, so more to come on that soon. But when we consider this emptiness as the absence of something, we resist it. And if you really let yourself instead rest in it, surrender, soften, not resist, then ultimately you lose your fear of emptiness. And of course, emptiness and fullness are in constant relationship. We learn this through practice, but we lose our fear of it. Some of you have a long-term practice of beginner's mind, which is a teaching from Zen, and some of you it might be new to, but for the person who asked this question, beginner's mind is a really good entry point, because it's just the acknowledgement that in any moment we can meet life with the mind of a beginner, the mind of childlike wonder, acknowledging that every single moment of our lives is fresh and new. Every moment of our lives is fresh and new. But we're often meeting life so filled with identity or positionality or beliefs that we're not open to this newness. So I'll remind you about beginner's mind because that creates a more easeful entry point. Just like a child. So I want to apologize for any technical challenge. Sometimes that happens. So I appreciate your patience and understanding. And as we begin to bring it to a close, first, I just want to thank you for being here today. Really, really thank you for this conversation, for this time. And I want to thank Sangha Live. I really, really love the space that they hold every time. And I want to remind people that it takes resources to put on this work, to call in teachers from all over the world to gather in this way. And so you are invited to offer Donna the spirit of generosity and reciprocity, supporting teachers and supporting Sangha Live to help make these teachings, make practice more available. I also want to, I'm just pausing to read a couple of the messengers. Let's dedicate the merit together. So acknowledging, if we will, the kindness, the care, the generosity, the beauty, all of the heart's intentions, filling the space, acknowledging the power of Sangha, of community. I would like to dedicate the merit of our practice together to all beings across time and space, visible and invisible, seen and unseen, born and unborn. If there's anyone in your field, your community, your heart, who you want to right now send and imagine sharing the merit of our practice together, please do so. Thank you.